As you know, beloved listeners, my day job is as a farm labourer on the family farm, where I belt around on the ATV mustering sheep and cattle, helping Patrice with her beehives and our modest crops of olives and garlic. But I'm going to introduce you to a completely different concept in farming involving, would you believe, well, jet setters dripping with diamonds, driving Lamborghinis and hanging out in their Manhattan condos with the rich and the powerful. In fact, they are the rich and the powerful. And my next guest is going to reveal all. He's an expert on agricultural policy. During the 2020 US presidential campaign, he advised the likes of Elizabeth Warren of loving memory, Bernie Sanders, and before serving as co-chair of the Biden campaign's Agricultural Antitrust Policy Committee. Austin Frerich is deputy director of the Thurman Arnold Project at Yale, and his first book, Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry, just been published by Island Press. And Austin joins me from the ancestral home in Idaho. Welcome to the Little Wireless Program, Austin. And spoiler alert, you're going to tell us how the rich and the powerful in the food industry operate. How rich and how powerful?
My favorite example is my dairy barons. Their operation is in Northwest Indiana, just south of Chicago, but they claim residency at the Ritz-Carlton in Puerto Rico. They also have a million dollar condo in Chicago and another multi-million dollar home in Indiana. But I think the fact that they claim residency at the Ritz-Carlton says a lot.
And we're not just talking about American farmers. We're also talking about a group of family businesses, family businesses from thither and yon, the barons, as you call them, and they globally operate.
Yeah. So Walmart's my grocery baron, and I kind of view them as my king of kings. And in fact, they are the richest family in the world. They're the largest company we've ever seen in the food system in the history of mankind.
That is absolutely awe-inspiring. And of course, they're well and truly a force in Australia.
I think of Walmart as the closest example America's ever had to a Soviet Union-style Politburo. With Walmart, there's no negotiation. I had a grocery person tell me, Philip, that with Walmart, it's supply and command. You don't negotiate with the world's largest, the richest family. They dictate to you.
Now, before we get into the details of what you found out about these the barons, I want you to tell me how you, how you found yourself going down this rabbit hole. I want you to take me to a bar in Iowa.
Yeah, so it's kind of one of those, kind of hipster old dive bars. This was in 2018, and at the time, I didn't know this. So I'm from Iowa, and my home state has no campaign contribution limits. And so this was a really competitive governor's race going on at the time. And this political person I was BSing with was telling me how this hog couple gave the most money so far in the race. Jeff and Deb Hansen had given the governor of Iowa over $300,000. Not only that, this person was telling me how they have a home in the only gated community in the state, and they also have a home down in Naples, Florida. And I kid you not, they have their own private jet that they fly back and forth between the two. And allegedly on this jet are the words, "When pigs fly." And to be honest with you, part of my head is like, that's good copy. That's a good story. But what a powerful symbol that's happened to my hometown of Iowa, that the most politically powerful person now in the state is a hog farmer. So that's what kind of led me down this whole thing is, how did one man come to amass or sell 5 million pigs in a year?
You realize that the barons, like the Hansons, who is it, Jeff and Deb, the so-called hog barons, are the norm, not the exception.
Yes, that's a big point of my book. Is someone once told me in the grocery industry that big boys like to run with big boys. Once you create one robber baron, you create a bunch of other ones. And so what I realized after writing that story of Jeff and Deb Hansen, I realized, what I see here in the hog industry, I see this across the food system in America. And even that your farm it's such an outlier. I mean, first of all, your farm is just brilliant in that it's almost like a good retirement portfolio. You have a bunch of different income sources. And what's happened in America in the last few decades is basically farms are becoming one thing. Increasingly, they're corporatized, industrialized, and they're also incredibly fragile. Besides all these highly toxic, destructive production models, it's just a very fragile, broken system.
You say that since the administration of Reagan in the 80s, the rhetoric of the free market has been cleverly used to thwart government oversight.
I want to be careful when I wrote this book not to romanticize the past, because there's some really good lessons to take from the past. But even, you know, the history of agriculture in America is rooted in slavery and genocide. That said, with the election of Reagan, you just see this pro-corporate framework take hold where this is such a simple thing, but it's so fundamental. I realized a few years ago that the goal of any corporation, of any executive, is monopoly. So you have a fundamental tension between business not wanting, between government not wanting monopoly because it's bad for innovation, bad for farmers, bad for workers, and business wanting it. And basically with the election of Reagan, all the guardrails came off and you've seen this massive consolidation of power in the hands of a few people.
I find a revelation on every page of your splendid tome. I'm going to list some of them. Today, three firms control 61% of American market for eyeglasses. Three firms control 67% of the drugstore market. Four firms control 76% of the market for air travel. And I love this. Two firms now control 64% of the market for disposable nappies.
My favorite is one firm controls like 50% of the peanut butter market. And what's even wild about that is it's likely higher. It's just a lot of these companies do store brands, the generics. We just don't know. And usually only know is when there's a recall. So these market shares are actually probably higher than those current figures.
I've just found another, which is a joy to behold. Two firms control 82% of the market for coffins.
Yes. And even like when you think about baby formula, that's very concentrated too. I don't know the numbers off the top of my head, but it's near the coffin number. So basically from birth, you know, from cradle to grave, it's incredibly concentrated.
We'll come to the conditions that facilitated this consolidation of power. But first, tell us, how many people who work in the food system in your country are actually farmers, Austin?
That's a good question. I mean, that to me is a big undercurrent in my book is, what is a farmer? All my barons pretend to be farmers. But if you lived at the Ritz-Carlton, are you a farmer? Or is it the undocumented men doing all the work on your operation, the real farmer? That's hard to say off the stat off the top of my head. I focus more on those who work in the food system. And when we talk about that, we're talking about 1 in 10 of Americans. So a lot of these people are just low wage workers for these industrial titans.
You say that, you make the point that you come from Iowa. And one of the things that spurred you on in your research was wanting to know why your home state has changed so much. Tell us about the transformation. The sad transformation that you have witnessed.
Yeah. So my book opens with this story, my hog baron, and that's really the story of what happened to Iowa. And I find that chapter just profoundly sad, where you have the best soil in North America, my home state. It should be the Italy of North America. It should have a very diverse food system. Yet it has the second highest cancer rate in the United States. It's one of the most obese states. None of the food you eat there is from there. It's just incredibly industrial. You drive the landscape now and it's industrial. It's empty. It's dead. It's barren. You don't see animals. You smell them. We've basically shoved most animals into these massive sheds called confinements where they never see a blade of grass. And so what used to be independent middle-class family farms are now just low-wage workers.
Some decades ago, I had a pig farm on the other side, on the far side of our 10,000 acres, and the ambrosial scent, the stench used to waft over when the winds were in the right direction. There's nothing quite as toxic.
No, it's toxic in so many different ways. Even just from like, you go inside one of those hog factories, industrial hog facilities, those gases are overwhelming. I mean, we don't even regulate them. There's been calls to regulate that for decades. I mean, there's tons of stories in rural newspapers where people walk into these buildings. If the door shuts behind you, It usually knocks you unconscious, and people tend to fall into these manure lagoons and then they drown to death. I mean, that's what they did during COVID, actually, is they shut the ventilation things and they suffocated the pigs to death.
Meanwhile, Deb and Jeff are not exactly knee-deep in manure.
No. My last book event on my book tour was in their hometown. And I'm not going to lie, I was a little afraid going into the heart of the beast. But I was actually shocked at how many, first of all, 50 people showed up in a town of like 5,000 people. But I kid you not, more than half the people stayed behind afterwards just to tell me all these stories of this couple. You know, their lies, their promises they didn't keep, and just how destructive their model has been to their hometown and the degradation of quality of life these people have endured.
And you observe that in your short life, the number of hog farms has declined by 80%.
Yeah. And we shouldn't be shocked that extremist politics have filled this void. I mean, that's a big point I try to make both in my hog chapter, my hog baron, and my coffee baron, is monopolist finance fascist. And I think that's a very, very important point given this moment, not only in America, but globally.
Let's look at some of the pollution problems from these mega farms. You already pointed out that workers have health issues. I understand they have a much lower life expectancy than average. But what about the runoff?
That's the big thing. So 60 to 70% of the waterways in Iowa are just too toxic for people to go into. I mean, a hog defecates about three times more than a human being. So Iowa has about 25 million hogs. So that's about the manure of 75 million people in one state. That's the population of California, Texas, and Illinois combined. And part of, you know, giving all that money to the governor is the regulatory agency that would oversee that has been gutted. So you have too much manure in the waterways. Keep that in mind. That's just hogs. Iowa also has a ton of cattle, ton of chicken. You have all the fossil fuels used in grain production. The waterways are an open sewer at this point.
God, how tragic is that? Where's the EPA in all of this, the Environmental Protection Agency?
What they can do here is very limited. In that legislation is they can't, their hands are tied on how they can regulate agriculture. And then when they try to kind of dance around it, industry throws up a ton of money with these advertising campaigns saying that they're attacking the family farm, which, I mean, clearly they're not. They're just trying to get robber barons to pay their fair share and not destroy our environment. But that's usually what happens here.
I have a vague memory that the EPA was one of the few good things that Richard Nixon did.
Yes. Isn't that funny?
So he creates the EPA, a light on the hill for you know, for the United States, but it is, you suggest, virtually impotent.
Yeah. I mean, the key thing here, though, is personnel. Personnel is policy. Who you appoint to these agencies is everything. And when you put in kind of pro-corporate people without a backbone, they bend to industry pressure. And that's been the story for both political parties for the last few decades in this space.
I'm talking to Austin Frerick, who's Deputy Director of the Thurman Arnold Project at Yale, and we're discussing his book, Barons, Money, Power, and the Corruption of America's Food Industry, just published by Island Press. And let me remind you, dear listener, we're discussing the barons who also rule pretty extensively in little old Australia. Now, tell me about the role of trade associations and trade agreements in helping, well, the likes of the Hansons expand their businesses.
Yeah, I'm glad you asked. So the American consumption of pork has essentially been flat for the last few decades, but we're producing more and more. And that's basically for export. And mainly that's going to Asian countries, notably China. And so we're essentially destroying rural Iowa to feed China because we're willing to cut more corners than they are. But in the bigger picture in the food system is these trade agreements have allowed a race to the bottom. You see that with produce. A lot of produce is moving to developing countries that are willing to look the other way on the environment and labor issues. And what that means is you're seeing more children working in the food system. You know, you have children picking berries for children to eat in developed countries. And as these supply chains get longer and longer, transparency collapses and abuse gets worse. And I should also say, I mean, that's just, first of all, it's bad for the climate. When your food comes from thousands of miles away. And it also makes for pretty bad tasting food.
Just as we found something nice to say about Richard Nixon, let us tell the listener that the lovely Jeff and Deb have their Hanson Foundation, which gives free ham to schools and pork chops to charity.
Oh, yeah. That's agriculture media full of stories like this. So what I find kind of funny is that they have their own spokesperson. And their spokesperson is always letting the news media know that, hey, on Christmas Eve, they're not handing out pork chops, but their staff is. You know, they might be down in Florida at their Naples home, the multi-million-dollar home, enjoying the Florida weather. But as it's snowing in Iowa, they're making their employees hand out pork chops. Instead of paying people more, instead of not destroying the environment, that's their way of just trying to buy good publicity.
I suspect that Jeff and Deb aren't handing much money out to the Thurman Arnold Project at Yale.
No. They did respond to my book, though. In the Des Moines Register newspaper, they wrote an op-ed about 2 weeks ago just saying what they're doing is actually good for Iowa. They engage in sustainable practices, yada, yada, yada. I mean, you know that whole corporate speak where...
I suddenly remember a wonderful song from the musical version of Little Abner. What's good for General Bull Moose is good for the USA. Now, let's meet the Cargill McMillan family, the grain barons. Introduce us to them.
The Cargill family they weren't my original plan for this book. Because honestly, I heard of them. I grew up around them. I played soccer next to a Cargill plant. I went to church by a Cargill plant. But they're not consumer facing. They don't put their name on anything. But what I realized is, Cargill is the closest thing we have to a modern day Standard Oil. They're all about owning the rails. They're all about moving grain. They move 1 in 4 grains in the world. They are the largest private company in America. They are bigger than the Koch brothers. I even think-
I'm sorry, run that past me again. The largest private company in America?
Yes, they are bigger than the Koch brothers, the famous Koch brothers. They are bigger.
Well, that would make them the largest private company in the world, wouldn't it?
Yes, for decades, though. I think it goes back to, they kind of trade off with the Koch brothers, but essentially they're the largest private company in the world going back to the 1960s, to my knowledge.
And at least 100 family members are billionaires.
Yeah, I mean, I think of them... As actually a better comparison is they're almost like the 19th century British Empire because the sun never sets on their empire anymore. I mean, they're still in Russia. They don't care about what Putin, because you don't know who they are. And so you can't boycott. They don't face consumer backlash. So they want to be in every grain production region in the world, and they want to shape those markets to their personal benefit. And
now,
they have.
You make the point that the company is a major player in grain, producing corn syrup, starch, livestock feed, and involved in, well, meat packing, but energy trading. What's that about?
It's about ethanol. So the whole farm bill in America is now designed for Wall Street and people like them. It's designed to overproduce grains at the expense of anything else. Basically pushes you to not grow produce or do animals online. It pushes you to do corn and soybeans. When prices get low, instead of, you know, growing apples or something, you're just given more subsidy to grow more corn. And so every year is a record corn crop. And so essentially ethanol has filled that void. So now the single largest use of corn in America is ethanol, which is a total joke of a program. It's a waste of a program. We are burning corn in our cars. We're using the best farmland in the world, and we're just lighting it on fire. I didn't even want to talk about this at first because I'm from Iowa. Like, everyone talks about ethanol. I'm so sick of talking about it. But it's 2024. If you believe ethanol is good for the climate, you believe the world is flat. Like, there's just no conversation here.
I'm going to read a quote from their brochure explaining their omnipresence, and it is almost as beautiful a piece of prose as the Declaration of Independence. Here we go. We are the flour in your bread, the wheat in your noodles, the salt on your fries. We are the corn in your tortillas, the chocolate in your dessert, the sweetener in your soft drink. We are the oil in your salad dressing and the beef, pork or chicken you eat for dinner. We are the cotton in your clothing. We the backing on your carpet and the fertilizer on your field or in your field. That's a lovely piece of writing, isn't it?
Oh, that's world-class writing. I mean, I've never
They must have a sort of an in-house poet laureate.
I mean, that is the single best display of power I've ever seen a corporation say before in my lifetime.
Well, how the hell did they get so big?
Two things. It took me a while to realize it. Number one, they use middlemen. And what I mean by that is they never do anything themselves. They always give money to a third-party group who then does their bidding. So they never attack anything. It's really, really hard to know. They don't hire lobbyists. You just really kind of have to ask around, and people have a sense, but the way they exercise power is very discreet. That's huge. And the second thing, too, is it's just the fact that they're about moving the middle. And because they're private, they don't have to disclose as much. So it's actually really, really hard to find out what they own, how much they own, where they operate, all that kind of stuff.
You take us back to Abraham Lincoln's Homestead Act of 1862. Why?
Because that's when around when Cargill was founded, actually right near where my family's homestead used to be in Iowa. I think Cargill's founded about 13 miles away from my family. My family is our Irish potato refugees who came to Iowa. And I just think the fact that they are founded around the same time as USDA is almost poetic, because I use their story to tell the bigger story of how they captured the Farm Bill in America, which is USDA's big mission. Of what used to be kind of a Goldilocks program that came out of President Roosevelt's New Deal of, you know, getting subsidies, but then having to engage in conservation practices, including pulling land out of production, which Cargill hated, to what I show is a systematic attack on that bill to now overproduce a few things at the expense of everything else. And my favorite little example is the modern farm bill, crop insurance. When most people hear that, they think, oh, that's for like rainy day, bad weather, that kind of thing. No. It's just insurance against low prices, and there's no cap on it. So what people don't realize is one of the largest owners of farmland in America is Bill Gates. So he can get as much price insurance for growing corn as he wants. That's what the system has become, because it's all for Cargill. And to me, the consequences of this are dire, but the best example of it is the obesity crisis in America. It takes money to be healthy at this point. And that is because heavily processed food is heavily subsidized. Highly processed food is, but fresh produce isn't. If you grow carrots, you don't get a dollar.
I grew up on a tiny, tiny little farm on the outskirts of Melbourne, and we were too poor to afford books. So every week I'd go up to the local lending library, and the first grown-up book I ever read, and I can still recall, I'm 12 years old, and the librarian hands me a copy of The Grapes of Wrath by John Steinbeck. And this is a secret, Austin, you mustn't tell anyone, but it led to me joining the Communist Party at the age of 15. Now, I mention Steinbeck because the Cargills also benefited from the Depression and the Great Dust Bowl crisis.
Yes. First of all, I'm a huge Steinbeck. East of Eden was my favorite book growing up. But yeah, I mean, the whole Farm Bill comes out of the Dust Bowl. Is what we saw in the Dust Bowl is the markets were glutted. They were overproducing, engaging in really destructive practices, but they were trying to save their land. So the whole Farm Bill was created to essentially get that equilibrium prize. And now we're at a point now where, I mean, so much of the American food system with the climate crisis just doesn't make sense. I mean, you have industrial dairy occurring in the West and aquifers that cannot sustain them, that are just awful for the cows, awful for the workers. It's truly hard to, my big point I want the readers to take away from this book is the system America has now is incredibly radical, and a lot of the reforms we're talking about are very traditional. Having a sustainable family farm is like what we're trying to get back to. The notion of one man owning 5 million hogs is truly radical.
I'd like you to briefly mention the history of the black tenant farmers.
Yes. That, to me, this history has really shaped a lot of the modern American food system. So in the South, the way when the Farm Bill was created, and because of the power of Southern Democrats, the money was administered at the county level. So black farmers did most of the farming in the South, white people on the land. So when these subsidy checks were given out, they were given to the landowner, but not the farmer. So these farmers were basically not allowed to plant and not given anything. They, you know, it's pick your word, your not politically correct word to say there. But, you know, that really triggered the Great Migration, the movement of Black farmers in the South to the North.
I'm going to quote you here, and you're a fine stylist. In other words, Black tenant farmers absorbed the sticks of the New Deal Farm Bill, while the white landowners enjoyed all its carrots.
Yes. What happened is that really exploitative model, that sharecropping model, started occurring in the chicken industry in America. Because a century ago, when America regulated its meat markets in response to Upton Sinclair's book, The Jungle, when they wrote the regulations, they didn't write chicken into the regulations because there weren't commercial chicken slaughterhouses. You literally had a chicken in your backyard and you butchered it. So what happened in the South is after this Great Migration, corporations started applying that model of production, that sharecropping model, to chicken. So if you're a chicken farmer in America to this day, you don't own the bird. You're given the feed. You take on a ton of debt to build these facilities to their likings. You babysit the bird. You then give the bird back to them. They weigh it in a room you cannot see. About 70% of chicken farmers in America now live in poverty. What's happened is this really exploitive sharecropping model production has replicated across the food system. They call it chickenization. That's what happened to the hog industry. Is my hog baron saw this model taking hold. It was one of the first movers. And then one of my barons in the book is Driscoll's, the berry company. They engage in this same chicken model production. They sell 1 in 3 berries in the world, but they don't grow a single berry. It's because they contract out the production to other people who can engage in very exploitive labor practices, but they can, you know, plead ignorant to it, but they get all of the benefits of this really exploitive power system.
Austin, I'm delighted that we share a love of Steinbeck, but we also, of course, honour Upton Sinclair, who's played an important role in the history of this immense tragedy.
Yes, we are. My slaughtering baron is the Brazilian company JBS. And my whole point of that chapter is we are back in the era of the jungle. We have children working at these slaughterhouses, and these companies face no consequence. And the thing that blew my mind, and I didn't even know this, and I like to think of myself as meat and dairy is my specialty, is these brothers bribed their way to monopoly level status. Not campaign contributions, but straight up bribes. They pled guilty to bribing over 1,800 Brazilian politicians to become monopolist. And what did we do? Nothing. They just had to pay a fine and they kept their monopoly. I mean, that is truly, I don't know. I read that chapter and sometimes I read it as I'm angry. Sometimes I read it as profoundly sad. But it's, I would think of them as the closest thing we have to a modern day criminal organization as a corporation.
Well, JBS have a huge amount of activity here in Australia. Now, we've already talked about Ronald Reagan, but let's now welcome Newt Gingrich, stage right. How did Newt change things for farmers?
I mean, Newt is just another one of those people that talks a big game for being on the side of family farmers, but he's just doing the bidding of the rich. I mean, you see a lot of people like that. The anger I had the most, actually, besides President Reagan, was President Biden's current Secretary of Agriculture, Tom Vilsack. He was governor of Iowa growing up for me, and I thought he was pretty good. But then you start realizing his history of he says one thing but does another. And the two examples I use is with JBS is number one. He's done nothing to address JBS. He actually still gives them U.S. government contracts because he admitted that they're just too big. And I've never seen a more bipartisan pinata politically in America than reforming the meat markets. You saw what they did to workers during COVID. They're gouging consumers at the store. Ranchers are screaming out for help. But not only has he not done anything, in the last 4 years, these markets have all gotten more concentrated, including JBS buying another company. And even worse, Walmart's even getting so angry that they're being shortchanged by these slaughtering barons that it's making its own massive vertical place into beef. It's building a beef slaughterhouse right now in Wichita, Kansas.
You remind us that Eisenhower's Secretary of Agriculture, that's back in the 1950s, told farmers to get big or get out.
Yes, but at least he never pretend to be your friend. Vilsack pretends to be your friend, which I think is incredibly worse for democracy. The example I use with Vilsack is in 2002, he was running for re-election of governor of Iowa. So the way Iowa works is only the governor of Iowa can stop the construction of industrial hog farms. And you saw a rural revolt. You saw farmers screaming for help. You saw these small town gyms in Iowa being packed with thousands of people not wanting these things built next to their homes. And Bill Sack's opponent was the head lobbyist for my hog baron. They ran TV ads. Bill Sack promised to do something. Then after he won, not only did he not do anything, he oversaw the largest expansion of hog industrial facilities being built in the state of Iowa in its history. So he looked people in their face and said, I'm here to help. And he stabbed them in the back. That is incredibly detrimental to democracy. That is worse than saying, at least Eisenhower's Secretary of Agriculture said, get out of here. He wasn't lying to you. Bill Sacks is much worse. That's what really bothers me the most.
I should alert local listeners to the simple fact that JBS is now the biggest pork processor in Australia, employing more than 14,000 workers across 50 sites and alarmingly moving into the highly problematic area of fish farming. Tell me about the Wall Street Farm Bill.
Yeah, the Farm Bill now is designed for Wall Street and no one else. What a farmer gets at the store for every dollar you spend, it's the lowest level recorded in American history. It's about 13 cents compared to about the high after the New Deal, where it was about 60 cents on the dollar. You have the obesity crisis in America. You see what's happening to the workers. By every metric, the Farm Bill is failing, except for Wall Street. And that is my big point, is I want people to understand how destructive this model is. It's just a corporate welfare program, nothing more, nothing less.
I want to come back to some of the methods the big companies use to maintain their enormous wealth and status, because there are patterns with each of the barons. Tell me about is it the Ryman family?
Yeah, this was the hardest chapter to write, but to me, to that point I said earlier about how monopolists finance fascists, I really want to tell that. So they are a secret German family. They entered the American coffee markets in 2012. And they now sell more coffee than Starbucks. They bought a ton of different brands. I use their story to tell the story, the history of competition protections and how essentially the Reagan administration, those guardrails have collapsed. Because decades ago, they could not have bought all these companies at once. And once they had this market power, they then used it to squeeze coffee farmers and the workers in these coffee stores. The family has a really dark history too in Germany. They were early and vigorous supporters of Adolf Hitler. They used slave labor. And then as their dark history started coming to attention a few years ago in the British press, they commissioned their own history. They promised not to do this again. They admitted their wrongdoings. And then right before I went to press, I about lost it because the Wall Street Journal reported that they're still in Russia selling coffee. And Putin is the closest example we have to a modern day fascist. And if you're still in there, your words mean nothing.
Okay, you say corporations like these use different brands to cater to different socioeconomic classes, and I guess also to blur the issue.
Yeah, I mean, it's that illusion of choice. With coffee, with my peanut butter, Baron, you see these different price points, and what you realize is with inequality, different consumers want to think they're buying different things, but you know, they're buying the same product. And so it makes the extent of the problem is hard for people to realize because they don't realize all these different brands owned by one company. That's the big thing.
We're used to talking of press barons, but with my guest now, we're talking barons of a different ilk. And introduce me now to Sue and Mike McCloskey.
Yeah, those are my dairy barons. And so they are part of an operation of 35,000 cows south of Chicago. Just from like a pollution standpoint, these cows produce as much manure as the whole city of Austin, Texas, in a given day. They produce as much milk to feed, 4 million school milk cartons. Their whole narrative in the press has been, oh, they care about sustainability, all that kind of stuff. And first of all, you realize where they operate their farm, you should not farm. It's an Everglade. I noticed that driving around when I first went there. There was canals everywhere. You look at EPA's website and all these are incredibly polluted. Undocumented men do all the work here. I uncovered in my investigation, they had a worker, an undocumented man die, got sucked into their manure machinery. He had three children. And he was also, I should say, Mike was a finalist to be named President Trump's Secretary of Agriculture. And he's the rumor is he's back in the mix again. But he loves to pretend to be a farmer. Yet, you know, as I said earlier, he lives at the Ritz-Carlton. So you tell me.
Time for the all-American family, the Waltons.
All the Waltons. I think of the Waltons as the King of Kings. When people come to get groceries, they don't make much money on groceries. They don't really care. They make money when you buy tennis balls when you're in the store. So now they aggressively, you know, they entered the grocery business essentially when I was born. Now they sell 1 in 3 groceries in America.
To the expense of the small local grocer who's just disappeared.
Yeah. I mean, the thing with them is big boys like to run with big boys. So the creation of Walmart as a grocery baron has essentially created other barons. That's how Driscoll's became a baron, is they saw the rise of Walmart. They realized one company wants 4 berries for 4,000 stores year round. And so what you see is massive consolidation in the food system because companies want to have some kind of bargaining power against, what truly is Godzilla.
Well, the oligarchs in other parts of American life, they, of course, are anti-union.
Yes. You have the world's richest family, yet most of their employees depend on a massive amount of government welfare because they aren't paid enough. This estimate's about 10 years old, but it's about, an average is to be about $5,000 per worker. And keep in mind, a lot of their clientele uses a lot of government money for food assistance, too. So you have a lot of their, you know, employees are on food assistance, their clientele's on food assistance. All for the world's richest family.
What an ugly paradox. Now, what's been the impact of all these mergers for everyday Americans, Austin?
That's the dark, funny part is industry and all these barons will say, well, we make cheap food. But when you actually dive into the numbers, that's just not factually true. Dollar for dollar, Americans spend more on food than most Western democracies. I'm getting a lot of traction with this book in the business world in America because Americans go abroad and they realize just how awful our food system is we're paying more for garbage. But that shouldn't be shocking. I mean, that's kind of economics 101 is concentrated markets, monopoly, they gouge. That's what they do. And when you have a food system full of monopolists, of course they're going to gouge consumers, which is just rampant at this point. And people are paying the consequences for it.
So a lot of these characters will be hoping that the Donald wins another term.
Yes. I mean, my dairy barons were very early supporters of him. They gave him a massive amount of money. But here's the thing. Because of the dark money system and campaign finance in America, we just don't know how much is flowing into the Donald. And Donald, here's the thing with the Donald is, and that's the big point of my Coffee Baron chapters, you get people like this, these strongmen emerge in moments like this, these laissez-faire Gilded Age moments, because people are angry and he taps into the anger. But instead of blaming the monopolist, he blames the immigrant. He blames the minority. I mean, that's why you got to fight power with power. You got to fight these barons head on, or else you see people like him come along and tap into the anger and use it in really destructive ways.
Now to the easy part, Austin. Give us the solutions.
Honestly, the simplest thing is put animals back on the land. We have to end this industrial model of meat and dairy production. It takes the temperature down. It's better for rural communities, better for the environment. It makes better tasting food. And the silver lining I have is that ethanol is going to die. The whole notion of putting cars in corn in your car doesn't make sense as cars move to electric vehicles and hybrids. And that's my hope is as that model dies out, we take that land that's in corn production, put it back in the pasture.
Well, come on, a few other suggestions before I let you go.
Yeah. No, that's my favorite suggestion. But the few other ones is, I mean, just old-fashioned trust busting. I mean, that's the thing about meatpacking that gets my blood going with Secretary Vilsack is we've done this before. We've broken up the meat companies. A lot of these companies, I mean, you just have to break them up. This isn't hard. I mean, it's more about the question of political courage.
Well, I must say, antitrust legislation over the generations has often been a very powerful tool in many industries.
Yeah, to me, one of the best appointments President Biden has done was appointment of a young woman named Nina Khan to the Federal Trade Commission. This young woman wrote a paper in law school, and she's the same age as me, how to break up Amazon, how it's a monopoly, how we need to reinvigorate antitrust enforcement in America. Her paper went viral. And now as chairwoman of the Federal Trade Commission, she's the one that's filing all these antitrust lawsuits against big tech. Here's the thing. She can't do that on meatpacking. USDA has authority for meatpacking. So I say strip USDA of that authority and give it to her. Give it to someone who's willing to do their job. It's also good politics. I mean, that's the wild thing to watch is you have really crazy Republicans like Matt Gaetz of Florida praising her in the Wall Street Journal saying how great she is. And so why not tap into that? Why not build a coalition? Because I'm a big believer in when you get strange bedfellows is when you get real reform.
Election looming, Austin. Either side of politics pledged to do anything of consequence?
I mean, it's Donald Trump is an existential problem to America. I mean, there's no other
to
way to
all
put it.
Of us, not, Austin, to all of us.
Yes, to the globe, to the climate, to everything. I mean, it is. I mean, I also say that as someone where most of my family are Trump supporters, there's a cult of personality there that I've never seen in my lifetime. And do not ever underestimate this man. He won his first race, and that was for the president of the United States. If you underestimate him, you underestimate him at your peril. This truly is a make or break moment. And it is, and like, we didn't even really talk that much about the climate crisis, how much agriculture is the second largest contributor to the climate crisis. And essentially it's been wasted, especially in the American context. And Philip, that's why I wrote this book.
Well, I'm very, very, very glad you did, Austin, because it's a hugely useful tool for critics of the system to deploy. It's been a privilege to talk to you. My guest has been Austin Frerich, Deputy Director of the Thurmond Arnold Project at Yale, and his first book in the proud tradition of John Steinbeck and Upton Sinclair is Barron's Money, Power and the Corruption of America's Food Industry, just been published by Island Press. Good on you, Austin.
Listen to more great stories that take you beyond the headlines. Ask your smart speaker to play ABC RN.